Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections. I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're happy that you can be here this evening.
Once again, I'd like to thank Schuler's Books and Music for their support of the Michigan Writers Series. And if you haven't already noticed, a representative from Schuler's Books is outside and is selling books by our guest tonight, Terry Blackhawk. So please do stop by and buy a book. I'd like to welcome this evening our guest, Terry Blackhawk. She is the founder and director of Detroit's acclaimed Inside Out Literary Arts Project. And she is the author of Body and Field and a chapbook trio, Voices from the Myths. Her second full-length poetry collection, Escape Artist, received the 2002 John Chardy Prize from BKMK Press. This year, Pudding House Press bought out her Greatest Hits chapbook as part of its Greatest Hits poetry archives. Terry's poems have appeared in Marlboro Review, Poet Lore, Michigan Quarterly Review, Southern Poetry Review, and Yankee, among others. She received the 1990 Foley Poetry Award, nominations for 4 Pushcart Poetry Prizes, and was a finalist for the Marlboro Prize in 1997 and 1999. Terry conducts workshops on the connection between writing and art at the Detroit Institute of Arts and teaches graduate-level writing classes for language arts teachers through Oakland University. She is the recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Teacher Scholar Award, a Michigan Governor's Award in Arts Education, a United Black Artists Pioneer Teaching in the Arts Award, and a Michigan Council for the Arts Artist in Residence Grant. Terry will read from some of her poetry, and afterwards we'll take questions from the audience. Will you please join me in welcoming Terry Blackhawk to Michigan?
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. My bag's in a mess around here. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks to good friends I see here in the audience for coming, and I feel like a real homecoming to East Lansing. My dad lived here for so long, and my mom. So, and my first book, full-length book, Body and Field, is a Michigan State University Press publication. So I thought I would start with that and just sort of hop and skip through the poems in both of my longer books and then some end with some new poems. The first poem, In Body and Field, is dedicated to my husband, so I can read it because he's not here to be embarrassed either. And kind of an interesting sideline about this poem is that when it came out, when the book came out, Poetry Daily, if you're not familiar with Poetry Daily, I highly recommend it. It's a website that publishes a poem a day. And when they get new books, they publish poems out of the new books and the journals that are all going on at the time. So they chose this first poem to represent Body and Field on Poetry Daily. And it's a love poem to Evan. And they actually, without knowing it, published it on our anniversary. So, it's called The Dawn of the Navajo Woman for Evan. The Navajo medicine woman gets up early to greet the sun. So my radio tells me, and so I stay tuned, though you already showed the way of greeting. Simply to hold this winter the hickory nut brushed free of snow, the plain prize beneath the season's tree. Perhaps it's the way your arch fits my instep curves over your arch, but we've kept at it these years, our limbs linking and unlinking deep in the quilting, and still a hunger for skin, not sleep, leads me onto you, your hand on my breast, or your calm talk of death and the ghosts of our ancestors, all of them gone into the crowded earth. Such comfort and ease I can almost consider becoming mulch myself or ash, and I wonder at how a rush of heat can disperse into something so much bigger than I am that it leaves me pulsing, ignoring what's beyond, daring to dispute the frozen ground. The pre-dawn sky offers an arctic green below a blanket of flaming clouds. I try to imagine the devotions of that Navajo woman, but get only as far as yesterday, when we detoured through a graveyard seeking, after shopping, a more quiet crowd. The sun dazzled us, stark trunks thrusting upward in the polar air, a batch of mallards in a bubbled pool, and all around the bright, untroubled snow. In the granite names, I read the luck and rhythm of even this hair's breadth of a life, your breath with mine, the branches swirling by, and the bobbing ducks, their emerald heads flashing a green and palpable fire. Now, the first section of Body and Field is poems about marriage and motherhood, and this next poem is called Dancing with My Son. And I read this at a reading in Wisconsin, where my son had just started teaching at the university there, and the reading was set up before he got the job. So it was a little discomforting for him to have his mom come to town to read poems. So I got these instructions, okay, Mom, all right, just don't read anything about me. So, but one of his friends was in the audience, and she'd already seen the book, so it was a small crowd, so I said, were there any requests? And one woman said, well, would you please read Dancing with My Son? So I had to oblige. Just goes to show you're never too old to embarrass your children. But this one is from a wedding we went to. Dancing with My Son. Everybody's doing it, this downright boogie down hustle and twist. We're trout, responding to a built-in magnetism, some homing sense that sends us leaping up ladders against the falling water. Were we born to this? When I ask my son how he learned to dance so well, he says, it's in the genes, that pool that pulls us in to this swirl of couples on the floor. The DJ alternates reggae thumps with a swept away sentimentality. It's Elvis, and we're all fools rushing in under the predictable mirrored ball. Someone waves a wand of bubbles. My friend says, he was supposed to marry me as her son dances with his bride. I won't catch the bouquet. I am joined in a new union of mother, son, he as surprised as I, though there's no uncertainty, just his fragrance, his shirt, his broad-shouldered, slow-stepping grace. He enters a world I think he'll master, and I'm part of it. This primordial room, its surge of arms, bodies, flow, it's the sea, and I can't help falling. We're underwater, creatures who bob through tides of rhythm and light. We're YMCAing, loosening ties, losing inhibitions, until I'm rising, lucky as a balloon with my new partner, who knows exactly when to let the string go. And one more of what my friend, when I first started writing, called Aging Mother Poems. This one is called Commencement. It's in three parts. I'll just read the first part. And Homs is a city in Syria that I actually visited when I was in college and traveling through Europe and the Middle East. And the city is called Homs. Commencement. Like the boys I once saw in Homs flinging themselves from the topmost turn of a Roman water wheel, their arms and legs wildly akimbo, caterwauling, graceless, yet full of a coltish grace. My son casts his eyes to the ceiling, speculates about the plants, wolfs his food, restless, ready to reach the top of this one wheel's turning, his first outward launching, making him nervous, skittery, unwilling to answer even the most direct question. How the water wheel must have creaked and groaned then beneath those Syrian boys. It was amazing. A monument turned plaything, Over and over, they climbed and sailed out, shrieking through the bright air, catching the turns just so, spilling with the water, but disdaining for the moment its gravity. Circumscribed by today, and less apparent than a tourist in a dusty land, I'm amazed to think of those boys as I watch him finding his foothold, nearing the apogee, asking nothing, poised above the pool, casting about for the finest way down. Second part of Body and Field are poems of myth and childhood, and one sequence of poems comes from the myth of the Minotaur. Pasiphae, I think is how you pronounce it. Or maybe, does anybody know? Pasiphae was the mother of the Minotaur. And I was doing a workshop with, you were asking about how I am a Michigan poet, and there are many other things I could think to answer now that we're not doing the interview, Michael. But one of the things that I did for a number of years was to teach poetry for the Michigan Youth Arts Festival, which is a wonderful festival for young people every spring in Kalamazoo. So one year I was doing some poetry using the myth of Icarus with these kids, and it was great. But the girls wanted to know about Pasiphae, you know. So I started thinking, oh, what about this? So the mother of the Minotaur was married to King Minos, who was the king of Crete. And Minos had been given this gift from the god Poseidon, this bull from the sea, to indicate that he should be the king of Crete because he was vying with his brothers. But the bull was so beautiful that Minos decided that he would sacrifice another bull instead. Well, this enraged Poseidon, and he caused Pasiphae to conceive of this lust for the bull, which she consummated thanks to the machinations of Daedalus, the court artisan, and as a result, the Minotaur was born. And Daedalus then created the labyrinth to hide this shameful creature. So she's another one of the women in mythology that, you know, kind of gets a bad rap. So I did a series of Pasiphae poems. Pasiphae, what she wanted. What she wanted. I wanted to be the sun and the moon framed in the same window. I thought I could land forever on my feet. Thought whatever tide tumbled and pummeled me would thrust me upright at last on solid ground. I had no idea edges could blur so completely, wishes changed to curses, and the seed of no return fasten in my womb. Beast, yes, though the god could have sent me anything, a frog, a duck, so bored I'd become with the king and his self-anointed ways, years of the same endless slap of waves against our shore. And if I was water-witched, it was not water I wanted, but its massive manifestation, surge made solid, all that briny spume and foam turned flesh, the mountainous might and hulk of him. No mere ox could ease the sorcery, no woodland song dispel what seeps from the corner of the eye. It set me nights wandering our moonlit grounds, the earth cindery as spent lava beneath my feet. She walks along low tide at sunset. In the foam's amber wash, she marks cessations of desire, mistakes bird's foot for crab trace against the trembling sand. The hour hands her its shadow, so stunning an inversion it seems she's let decades go by, determining the precise role of the wave, fish scales that flash like minuscule coins or eyes. No music now, no trumpets, moans, just the surf's insinuating sighs, and if watchers spread tales, what of it? She's settled in for her aftermath here, where breath arrives on behalf of this bronze-edged slant as she succumbs each day to the dropped sun cascading down the ladder at the end of the world. No salt, no pity. I tried to go beyond the extremes, but all I learned was not to lean too far into corners. I'm good now at pretending I don't hear my name wound around knife-thin whispers. These days, tenderness no longer feels like tinder. I've forgotten how to flash, then flare. If only I could find that fire, I'd hurl words, essential as salt, against these wretched walls. Halfway walking. I do not deserve these daughters for whom wind's a word they name but cannot spell. They're all grace notes, time bundles, while I've become the sandal-footed one, returned from another realm, not of death exactly, but a new way of bumping against things. It's no mere tale that the night skies fill with horses. My daughters gave me this story, and I believe them. Sort of skipping through here. The last one on Pasiphae is I found out that actually she was a Cretan goddess prior to, you know, the sort of typical Athenian religion, and that she was the daughter of the sun and the moon. And I didn't know that when I wrote that line. And that the bull was her totem, and that her cult spread to Spain. So now we have Pasiphae invents flamenco. This is body as beast. I have no scripted smile to reassure you. Watch as I arch my back, face downward, square shoulders above dangling arms. I can be a bull or its tamer. My feet assert their own rhythms as I face, faint, dodge. Then arms entwine, spiral up, and como la paloma, I am a dove, fingers fluttering from the tip of my frame. I don't ask for help, but if you clap, sustain it. Give me hands, incessant as the wind. And if you sing, make it not melody, but cry. I want pure grito from mouths formless as despair. When you look at me, you will know you are looking passion or pain in the eye. Another Michigan influence is having been a Detroit teacher for so long. And this one also actually picks up a little bit on the myth of the Minotaur. This is called February Teacher. February Teacher. Like Ariadne with her thread, I pass our grated storefronts, hopeful shingles, tonsorial parlor, Nubian patios, blur by. The burden is great this month, the skies lower. Three stout women with mops stand at the door of the temple of deliverance, bend to the cold, pat their pockets for a key. I can't avoid this catalog of signs. These cubistic messages leap out at me from gritty, angular surfaces. Salt dried in the asphalt crackles underfoot. Today we talked about Thoreau treading his path to the pond, and I know I mourn most a loss of memory, how the buildings sagged around this intersection lock out the impressionable earth. I didn't do Henry justice today, but I was looking for you, and you'd driven on with a laugh and a wave. It was last year you ducked past me through the classroom door, grinned and said, I think I'm a transcendentalist. I'd never take in all this architecture at once, perpendicular planes, boarded windows, but I think how you'd take this same roadway and stretch it as far as you could into a straightaway, the Harley between your knees purring, echoing your not-so-nascent energies, drawing you away from our fumes into mint and leather on the wind. You'd cross open pastures and wade waist deep in the waters of the mind, and I send you on, tanked up, ready to go. It's my job, you see, to re-thread the maze again and again, never minding the scenery or lack of it, one-way streets, dead ending. The story always repeats itself. You survive the labyrinth. Of course you leave me behind. Midsummer nights will find me, beached, alone, not regretting. As I look up, hear you roar away, and the stars bend to join me. And that was kind of the last image of when Ariadne was taken off with Theseus. You know, he left her on the beach, and she was sort of taken up into the heavens. Another Michigan poem is dedicated to Larry Pike, who was a really good writer friend for a long time. He died in 1995, I think. And I think I have a Larry poem in every one of my books. We were part of a group of thespian poets who did this Still Life with Conversation, and Larry and I taught a couple of summers together doing workshops for kids at Olivet College when they had a summer institute for gifted and talented high school kids. So Larry was just a great guy. So this is the first part of Twilight Body and Field, which is dedicated to Larry. I refuse to harvest this news of illness floating through your veins, and I cannot see you there, sliced, stitched, stunned by the doctor's verdict. Write you off? Never. It is late summer. Tomatoes burst from vines. Kernels of corn swell with milk. And now these fields bending to a twilight that makes ears of wheat seem lit from within. Is it consolation to see vision as a gift not given to forcing in lucent bodies of grain? What brings us closer than the earth, I do not know. Except the growing world somehow becomes our story, and we speak from this together as we breathe. This is also a Larry poem. It's called How These Landscapes Dwarf Us. It's as if we're standing on some distant cliff, scanning a dim horizon. In the gorge below, a torrent rushes. Then sun dissolves the mist, and there they are. The capsized boat, its tiny passengers we watch but cannot warn, hurtling toward falls they cannot see. Or it's how, in the photograph by Edward Curtis, the Pueblo potter reverses figure, ground. Back toward the camera, shawl gusting up from the fire at her feet, she looks away to some vanishing point, forms a dark window against the sky. Easy these days to drift into landscapes and get lost searching what's beyond the frame. Better restrict our view, like peasants in Zen scrolls who occupy corners, take up less space than a bush, prod diminutive donkeys along ledges in the foreground. It's our last talk, a dim winter's day. Go to Paris, you say. Find the Japanese exhibits, those human figures, how small they are. Last trip there, you wore a beret, delighted to be asked to give directions. Now, like Bodhisattva on his turtle, robes flowing, eyes fierce and clear, you direct me to scrutinize brush strokes, observe the quick ink. Your silvery hair, finally grown back in, spilling, billowing out, as if caught by what mountain wind. I haven't been looking into Body and Field for a while, so I'm kind of lingering, but I want to move on to my new book too. So I'll do one more poem out of this. This one I'm happy to say is going to be part of a song cycle that a composer at the U of M is going to be putting together. She's doing a program called Songs About Words, and they're all ars poeticas of one kind or another. So this is called Letter Perfect, and it comes from the fact that I'm really a failed potter, and I would have liked to have been a potter early on in my life, but I couldn't get the knack of, you know, centering the wheel. Letter Perfect. It's also a little bit about how with dyslexia, I don't have it, but I mean, I worked with dyslexic kids, how you switch up letters, and so. Letter Perfect. Say ah for pottery, for poetry, say oh. The letters don't hold still, the T's switch with the E, and I'm in the mix again, sinking my fingers into the slip, that blend of earth and water, like blood or gravy, that eases the friction between hand and clay. Later, I learned a new word for it, slurry. And though that potter is dead now, still the word becomes his shy, burry voice and quick, skilled hands. He taught me to trust both slippage and speed, to ride the wet slur and hold on tight, pressing the opening, oblivious to flyings off. You pull and turn, pushing outward and in, till at last the form appears, the spun circle, ready to set and take to the fire, to turn molten, cool, then still, ringing. It's perfect, empty, oh. And we talked about birds. So I'm going to do a bird poem. It's the longest title I've ever titled a poem. It's called On the Mockingbird Singing in the Morning in the Barrio, a few blocks from the boardwalk on the beach in Venice, California. Above the bougainvillea, coming unstuck from this stuccoed urban maze, a mockingbird is doing the best he can to make something from the nothing that precedes him. The voice climbs, tumbles, and I wonder if he is riding or falling from the edge of his song, this song he doesn't own, just as a surfer's not master of the wave, no matter the moves. Mock soloist, our bird creates his own company. He's a manic one-man bird band, conducting himself in early morning excess beyond the hanging fuchsia, whose ruby silence is preferable, perhaps, to his cacophony. But he's at it again now, letting go or hanging on, his wheezing takeoff like a whip snapping, a carnival toy to twirl in the air. And in fact, he rises up for a moment, whirligig, wings a wind-up, then back to the branch and his aphoristic repetitions, the song gone a bit obsessive and bizarre. And we who grouse at his intrusions, blinking from sleep, ruffled for all we know by the latest passing boombox, what else to do but love the wild array of him, how he tunes himself up and gets it all in, this fly-right-up clown with his step-right-up patter saying, Towhee and titmouse, meaning meadow and glen, whatever it is, shape it, take it, to what, towhee, to what is given. So there we have a few birds. the title of Escape Artist is also a bird poem. So I will do that one. Escape Artist. A crow does not merely open its beak to cry or sing, but presses its whole body forward, playing itself like a bagpipe, pumping out cranky, cranked-up rhythms. Early March, branches bare of all but these new tenants whose raucous calls begin well before dawn, who daylong wheel from here to Breton Drive, conducting their business on our lawns. All week I've watched them, filling our neighbors' trees, displacing the air with their caws, less flock than visitation. To my friend who'd have it that the crow is negation made manifest, a thing with claws that perches on her shoulder, reciting endless tapes of whoever teased, carped, hurt, abused, I'd say send those sad tales through the maw of a ventriloquist doll, a human puppet she alone controls. For who can manage the wild lift of wings? Who pass through the dark windows crows place against the sky? If there's limit in what we say, each word a fence or boundary, it must be why the crows have gathered and gone now. I miss the rough rush of their risings up and settlings down, and that one I saw on Lancashire, dangling by its left foot, upside down from a wire. Electrocuted, I thought, surely dead, the dank, bone-filled rag of it, until it swiveled upright, flapped, then flew, glad, I suppose, to have looked at the world in a new way, to be leaving behind a dummy's point of view. And I probably should have prefaced that by saying that I was in a writing workshop once where the prompt was to imagine a crow sitting on our shoulders, telling us all the bad things that anyone had ever told us and talking back to the crow. So I thought, no, you don't do that to the birds. Do that to something else. So many of you knew my mom and dad. Mom passed away very suddenly in 2002. She knew that the manuscript had won the prize, which was great, and she had a version of it. And Dad had had a stroke about a year before that, which left him unable to read or write. So she was reading poems to him at night. She had gone through a couple of Billy Collins, a couple of poems a night. And so when we went back to the house, I found that there were two neat piles of my manuscript on the dresser, one that she had read, and presumably this was the next poem she would have read. And it's called Luck. Ironically enough. And it's a true story. Evan and I used to like to vacation on Pelee Island in Lake Erie. Luck. As the throb of the fan lulls us to sleep and the sky clears of its ragged green curtain of clouds, we breathe a simple peace, free of the storm that twisted and snapped a waist-thick branch from our silver maple and flung it across the yard against the wind's direction. We measured our luck then, plunging arms shoulder deep into a hole in the ground we could have found in the roof above our bedroom ceiling. Knock wood, pinch salt, tonight our luck's nothing more tangled than our limbs, sated and safe beneath the unbreached plaster. Tomorrow I'll step into the rain-washed air, chin high with relief, not hunkered like some medieval Eve cringing into the unexpected world, not like that couple we found last summer having sex in the abandoned lighthouse. I can still see them hopping into their clothes, covering their crotches, as if a sword-bearing angel pursued them. Their footprints in the muddy path from the parking lot out to the beach made a story we'd later reconfigure after coming on the luck of its surprise ending, his bare bum and her quivering thighs. Turning quick to save them from embarrassment, I thought Erie's wind-blown waves drowned out my retreat. Luck's my chance now to say I was not a tormenting angel, not a storm-bearing cloud. I was shushing Evan, backing away into the woods, trying to protect them, when they flushed into the open like a couple of quail, fleeing the earth they'd pressed for us to see. So, you know those folks, tell them I'm sorry. We didn't mean it. Oh, the this one's just kind of fun. This is a persona poem with a little odd little rhyme scheme. Just give this one a little change of pace. It's called, I guess this is good to read in an academic institution. It's called, After Years of Ethnographic Research, Professor Jones Retires to the Tropics. Don't get me wrong. Just because you see me tying on this sarong doesn't mean the seamy sides of these natives' lives entice me, or their soft culture, all fronds and coconuts, knives slicing down the moisture-laden fruit that drips sweetly from my lips. So yes, I guess I've become a kind of fixture here, my loosened dress disguising nonetheless an academic heart. But where's that gone? Here, where air's hibiscus mild, I seem to lose my rubrics, notes, and plans. I take in a new world's news on palmy sands. But isn't this, after all, what I've tried to teach my students hunkered fall and winter long? Open your eyes, I tell them. Put on an alien point of view. Make foreign skin the way you let your data come in. Like the waves around my toes, these too a proper tool for research. The endless flow's a pattern you won't learn in school. I tell them that as well. Transcribe everything? Yes, I say. You want your subjects natural. Have done your best to allay their charming native naivete? Then, of course, record, but tie the knot however you can. Do and record. No need to buy smiles from that bronzed young man. Like yours, his heart's as free as his warm Pacific glance. Go to it now. You're trained to see. You're honed with sensitivity. Pursue each fine nuance. So that was Professor Jones. This poem's about art, kind of filter through this book. And I got fascinated with the life of Emily Carr, the Canadian artist, who's the Canadian counterpart of Georgia O'Keeffe and Frida Kahlo. And in fact, there was a traveling exhibit with all three of these women. Carr took a lot of her inspiration from Northwest Coast Native painting and art and the forest. She was quite an eccentric. And lived in Victoria, British Columbia. And at one point in the early 1900s, she would just take off and travel up the coast, and she sort of made it her mission to record some of the art of the native villages that were all being kind of destroyed by the government. And the whole way of life was being destroyed, of course, that wonderful, rich Northwest Coast culture. So I wrote a couple of poems based on that, and so I'll end this book with these two, and then I wanted to read a couple of new ones. So from Emily Carr's, the sequence is called Force Fields. This one is Totem, Tsatsi Nukwomi Village, 1907, and she was quite a writer. In fact, she got more acclaim initially in her life for her books and then her painting. So this is one of her quotes. I slept in tents, in roadmakers' tool sheds, and in Indian houses. I traveled in anything that floated on water or crawled over land. Emily Carr, Totem. No more the timid student, too shy to view a naked model. You have come up the coast by boat alone, and are not afraid now to sleep alone in the emptied longhouse. You step gingerly past banana slugs, dodge dozens of famished cats that swirl underfoot as you tramp the rotting plank walk out to the edge of the abandoned Indian village. There, through clouds of mosquitoes and stinging nettles higher than your head, you slip, fall before Disinokwa, woman of the woods, stare stunned into the wild O's of her eyes, the black cavity of her mouth, its breath filling the air between the outstretched arms, the dangling eagle-headed wooden breasts. easy sacrifice if burning skin is all it takes to find her, this towering totem, partner of raven, figure to warn children against. Witch woman, hungry, unappeasable, you must paint her before moss and rain reclaim the carved column of her neck and the eyes that echo through you, as if you hear your own fear beating inside her body's hollow drum. And there was a whole exhibit of these totems, and the De Sinopus, that's just one huge totem pole devoted to the woman's body. It's not divided up into the different things. It's just as scary as all get out. And this one I'll do is Potlatch. Sophie was an Indian basket maker that Emily befriended, and in fact, she dedicated one of her books to Sophie. And I was just struck by how all that sort of Victoriana, we were in Victoria, you know, it's just like, they're so revered, this sort of Kipling kind of stuff, you know, everywhere. So this is called Potlatch, Victoria, BC. Tea time and the Bengal tiger in the Kipling room at the Empress Hotel still sends its stuffed snarl through sun-slatted afternoons, potted palms and lace. Down the street, past the place of your birth, herons fly from the park where you painted, pass above your house of all sorts in their daily departure for the shore. Today, De Sinopus stands display at the Royal Museum. Clay Wick, the Haida name you, laughing one. But by the time you finish your potlatch welcome, the crown will already have banned the dancers, locked up elders, grandmothers, the gift of feasting forbidden, the art of gifting abandoned, and all the weave unraveled until Sophie's 20 babies arrive, half starved and so silent, the gravestone carver, not unkindly, calls her his best customer, helps keep her tab alive so she might place another marker in the village's overgrown burying ground. And I'd like to read a few new poems, if I may. We have 5 more minutes, so, okay. These are about, a couple of them about my dad, and this one is called, and it's very recent, it's called It Is. After his stroke, he lost a lot of his ability to speak. He's come back quite a bit, although the aphasia is still pretty strong. Those of you who know him know he can come up with the most amazing insights and conversation regardless. This one is from the early days after the stroke, and it has as an epigraph from Herman Melville, "It is not down on any map. True places never are. It is." It is mid-September, days of dry, silent sky, and now this humid haze, a fog my father shares as he sits on the deck, barely 1 week home from the hospital, babbling less, but searching, more often staring up at the maples and through them to the school on the other side. The rest of us talk therapies and recovery. I think posting signs might help, and isn't there a good clinic in Ann Arbor? I go online looking for answers. It is early yet, weeks before he will be able to explain. Blasted, I was blasted, he'll say. And later, a great hand went through and swept everything away. Within a year, he will have tried and given up, and finally declined cards or books on tape or any more well-meaning notions of change. But this is the day when the prompt is egg, and he writes, sherd. Amazing, we agree, so much language still intact, but how laborious to uncover, how hit or miss to probe. An hour, and he's still at work on 12 short items, the slow pen laboring over the speech therapist's worksheet, the palmer hand with its discipline and rhythm, but the elegant slant is shaky now, so frail and lacy anything might slip through, cloud puff, sign bubble. Coffee stone, he proclaimed, when the intake nurse with her clipboard form asked him for his name. Call me. In his eyes at the time, I saw Lear on the heath. Or was it Ahab, his internet bridge handle, password to the game? Today, that bridge stands empty, hands gone, the deck cleared. The virtual waves he loved to travel have ebbed, hissing from his shore. And I want to reclaim it all, sea rack, beach glass, spindrift bits of legend dissolved from ink and paper into air, like the notations he stored in those long-gone shoeboxes filled with index cards, his own handmade concordance to the metaphors in Moby Dick. Then he'd been the eager grad student, awash in the symbolic ropes and lines, light, dark, and all the watery wild, netting every nuance, writing each one of them down. And what shall we call him now? Ahab or Ishmael, wanderer or scribe? His hand wavers off any map we know. I hope he is finding some true place, but for now he must write. The first word that comes to mind, it is. And one more for Ben. This is called Primer. I'll end with this one. It's a Sestina. Primer. These were the words you put in your pocket. Hearth, table, window, chair. These were the lifelines I wanted to give you in order to help you read. You taught me to read the music of words. I felt so grown up beside you. I found tobacco in your pocket. I loved reading the lines as I sat with you in your chair. Today you sit in your chair, no longer expecting to read. The doctor said, try headlines. You creased and caressed the words before putting them in your pocket, the ones I prepared for you, each word a sign for you, taped to table or chair. How precious they felt in your pocket, even if you could not read them, those fat, large font words with their unfamiliar lines. Now Mother says the lines of your own poems for you. Sometimes you recall the words, hearth, window, chair. Find other ways to read them. Put them in the pocket of your pajamas, pocket of sleep and dreams. Line them up heartwise to read however you can. I know you disdain the utility of chair without the magic of words. So I say to you, Father, read the moon. Tonight she pulls songs from the lining of her pocket and sings them for you, rocking in a chair of words. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Any questions? Do we get to do a Q&A?
How's your dad now?
Yes, he's moved up to live with my brother, and he's actually taken up bridge again, and they're having a great time. It's been a very good move. Yeah, he moved up in early October, yeah. And they are both night owls, and Tom's reading to him from Stephen Jay Gould, who's a big favorite. So it's been a good move. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, there are, and there are copies of Greatest Hits, too, and hopefully there will be another book sometime in the not too distant future.
Inside Out is hanging in there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Inside Out's hanging in. Well, let's see. We've got a lot of exciting things going on. A couple of our graduates who are now in college are doing a poetry workshop at a homeless shelter.
Wow.
With kids who are, it's transitional housing.
Wow.
So we just started that. I'm just really happy about that.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Skillman Foundation gave us a grant to do some expansion. So we have, that's part of it. We have these little after-school centers now at four different sites. Hopefully we can keep them up and running. And we had a wonderful gala, and Nikki Giovanni was our guest speaker. And you can all find out about us online at www.insideoutdetroit.org. There are a lot of pictures from that. So we're really hanging in there. We're in like 24 schools this year. Last year, a wonderful project took place with puppetry, where there's a wonderful theater in Detroit called Detroit Puppet Art Theater, and it's founded by some Russian emigres. And they came into a couple of our third grade classrooms and put together these scripts, and they actually had puppetry premieres, and the children had such an experience. It was so involving for them, and they had to learn how to get together and work together, and some of them kept quitting because they couldn't remember their lines, and they would, you know, they finally learned all about being responsible to each other and picking up for one another. And the themes of the plays, they wrote these little stories that were like classic folk tales, and they had all these magical elements, but they were all morality plays about learning not to be selfish or learning who to trust. At one school, the fox kept getting kicked out of school, so other people had to keep picking up the part. So it's very, it's really rewarding work.
That's a lot of lives.
Uh-huh.
24 schools.
Yeah. And we have I'm so grateful. I have a really great staff and very organized folks, and we have a nice camaraderie among our writers. And we do writer's orientation at the beginning of the year, so we really do a lot of keeping people up to date and helping and observing and training. So that's been very good.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in this area?
Mm-mm. We moved around a lot, and my folks moved here in, I think it was 1973 or something. And I was already living in Detroit by then. Mm-hmm. We were academic gypsies. Mm-hmm. California, Massachusetts, Georgia, and Indiana. Mm-hmm. Before the Bonhorse landed here, East Lansing became home.
And Turkey, right?
And Turkey, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'm working with a couple of colleagues. Grand Rapids.
Mm.
I'm writing. Let's see. So, and one of the things we're going to talk about is sort of best practices. So, what would you say is one of the things that worked really well for you in teaching in terms of students? Maybe I can steal something.
Free writing. Mm-hmm. Every day. I really believe that's a very, very important part of just the comfort of doing that, you know, even if it's just 5 minutes, it just loosens up the voice. It's, you know, I would really, really endorse that. Yeah. Brainstorming. What are you presenting on?
It's called Beyond the Five-Paragraph
Essay. Oh, please, yes. Let's get beyond that. The sooner the better.
That's a very nice.
Right, right. Yeah, beyond basics. Right. So I think that would be very. I think it gets people familiar with their own voices as writers. And also the fact that, you know, just the idea that writing is constantly changing, you know, tutored writers or, you know, kids are full of anxiety. I mean, they'll come in with their whiteout, you know, and they want it to be perfect the first time. and you just get the sense that it's just constantly, you know, changing, and you start over, pick one sentence, and that's all you use from a draft. It's, I think the fluidity is important. Yeah.
What was your first poem, Terry?
The first poem that I wrote since I was an adult is called Memorabilia, and it was, I'm actually, if this new manuscript ever gets out, it's in there. And I experienced what someone later identified as a muse attack, where I was sort of just overwhelmed by this moment about writing a poem, and I hadn't been writing before. It was in the context of first starting to teach writing at the high school, and we were doing a little publication in our English department. Head was encouraging us to bring in poems, so I thought, oh, I can write a poem, and all of a sudden I was just like swept away, and my grandmother had recently died, so I was all of a sudden found myself writing about that and crying, and so that was really kind of a big change for me. That was the first one I had written since I was in high school and college, anyway.
When did you write your first poem as a child?
As a child? Mm-hmm. I remember writing one about Halloween when I was in fifth grade. The teachers told us that a poem had to rhyme and it had meter, and so I went home and she didn't believe I'd written it. She said, "Now, Terry, your father helped you with this poem." I rhymed faces and grimaces. So,
yeah. I have something to tell you.
Okay.
I know someone who wrote the poem when he was 15 years old, and 45 years later, he won a first prize for this poem.
For that poem?
Yeah. Actually, he just revised it.
So that's about the longest I've heard of. I mean, a lot of my poems go, you know, like some have you pull them up 10 years later and you do more with them. 60, was it? 45 years?
Yeah.
Don't throw anything away. That's great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to talk with you. My pleasure.